Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Everybody, and welcome to this latest edition of Black Hole Cinema. I'm your host this week, Tony Black. Yes, I'm taking the reins for another special episode. This is a Jurassic special. Crap dinosaur noise, but there you go. It's the best I've got. It's all I've got in the tank. We're today going to be looking at all four now Jurassic Park slash World films over the last 23 years. With a little bit of news and box office figures in between, and indeed a brand new section which I'll be doing every time I host, called Director's Corner, which is going to focus on a specific director each time, and I will introduce the director a bit later on. We'll keep that one as a really exciting surprise. But who I will introduce right now are the guests, because joining me tonight are two of my old chums who are have been on the podcast before. Firstly, welcome Mr. Luke Asquith. Nice to have you back, sir.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Kind of just dropped off the face of the planet, but still around. I'm not a fossil yet.
Nice tie there to Jurassic Park. Very good.
I've got that on my notes.
Excellent. Not yet set in amber. This is excellent. Interesting fact, Luke is actually the first ever guest on Black Hole Cinema, because you were the first one I ever did an interview with back in the day.
Way back in the day,
a good year and a half ago. So yeah, you have that dubious honour of being the main guest. And also joining us tonight is the incorrigible, the effervescent, the ever present Mr. Pete Gaskell.
He wasn't here last week, but other than that, yes.
Yeah, also pedantic. Let me add. Yes, the pedantic.
Yeah, that's much more appropriate metaphor. But yeah,
if you had your own cartoon or film, I think you would be called the pedantic Pete Gaskell. Or
yes,
yeah, wouldn't it? Like, you know,
yeah.
The prodigious T.S. Spivey would be the pedantic Pete Gaskell.
I think pedantic Pete is the best alliterative nickname I've ever had. So I'm happy with that one.
You could have a lot worse.
I have
a lot worse, and I dare say you have been over the years.
Over the past week,
more than likely. So we're going to get straight into it, so to speak. And we're talking about four films tonight, so we've got no time to spare, and we're going to plough straight on, and we're going to go in order here. So we're going to call back. We're going to look back to a film I think that's very special to all of us, the very original, the first film, Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park.
Since the beginning of time, man has searched the earth for evidence of its past. But while some have looked for clues to the mystery, one man has found the way to bring the mystery back to life.
I own an island. The coast of Costa Rica. And I spent the last 5 years setting up a kind of biological preserve here.
On this private island, science has defied evolution.
Where do you get a 100-million-year-old dinosaur blood?
Genetics has mastered creation.
We've made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
Jurassic Park, which is my terrible attempt at an Alan Partridge impression.
I wonder if you're going to get that in there.
Yeah, it had to be in there. So, if you happen to have been living on Vulcan for the last 23 years and you don't know the plot of Jurassic Park, let me summarise. Obviously, made in 1993, directed by Steven Spielberg, from Michael Crichton's original novel, involves the titular park, a theme park in on an island of Costa Rica, where a slightly naive but extremely wealthy billionaire called John Hammond, played by Sir Richard Attenborough, breeds a entire theme park of dinosaurs for public consumption. And he hires Sam Neill's Dr. Alan Grant and Jeff Goldblum's Dr. Ian Malcolm as well as several others, to come and check out the park and check it safe, and inevitably, chaos follows! We must have... Well, you've obviously all seen this. Was this film as special to you as in your childhoods, even childhood? let's invent a new word. Childrenhoods.
Yes, why not?
Childrenhoods. It's fine. Was this film as special to you in your childhoods as it was for me?
Definitely. It was one of my favourite films, still one of my favourite films. Yeah, I don't know how many times I've watched that on VCR, and I'd always make sure when it finished I'd rewind it to my favourite bit, so the next time I put it on it'd be ready to go. But yeah, numerous times I've seen that film.
Oh, yes, same. One of the first films I ever saw in the cinema, and basically developed a bit of an obsession with dinosaurs I must have had for quite a long time in my childrenhood. Yes.
Childrenhood, yes.
It's a thing now. Like you said, Rick, it's one of those defining moments, wasn't it? Yeah. With you as well, Tony, where it just sort of hit, and then you just stayed with you for the next, you know, 5, 10 years, whatever.
Well, I was only 12, I think, when it came out. It was 1993. So to a 12-year-old boy, you know, that's just the greatest thing ever. And it was, you know, looking back now, obviously, it was riding off the crest of the wave of the new advances in, you know, CGI and visual effects that ILM championed in the early 90s, with primarily Terminator 2, really, which was the first time we ever saw, you know, those kind of wow, when the T-1000, you know, morphs, which I'm sure you're both familiar with. And that was the point where everyone went, wow, we can actually, and Steven Spielberg especially went, okay, we can do, like, it doesn't have to be men in rubber suits anymore, you know, or Ray Harryhausen stop motion kind of things. We can actually properly do dinosaurs now. And that was it. And then, obviously, you know, that revolution, in many ways, Jurassic Park was the start. If there was no Jurassic Park, there would probably have been no Phantom Menace. So we've got a lot to blame Jurassic Park for, actually. But it was these innovations by people like James Cameron and then Steven Spielberg, which led George Lucas to remake, you know, to make the prequels, and then all the onslaught then in the you know, the 2000s and everything of the CGI we have now. So, you know, the legacy of Jurassic Park isn't necessarily as good as the film, because it did open the door of a Pandora's box, really, in movie making, some of which is terrible. Transformers, but but the film itself, I think, is just. I mean, I watched it the other day. I watched it 3 times in the cinema when it first came out. I watched it when it came out in 2013 and a re-release, and, you know, I went back to the cinema and had the goosebumps all over again. It is timeless in terms of how
definitely
wonderful it is, I think.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's just... what were the goosebump moments for you two, do you think?
The gates.
Big one for me was when they first see them, and just the look on Ellie's face is the exact look I had when the camera pans around and you see them, and I've got goosebumps now just thinking about that, but that always gets me that bit.
I think it's that moment, isn't it? It's that kind of, you know, wow. It's because we hadn't seen them before, had we? It was the first moment you'd seen anything like that on film, and I think the way that he built that up as well, you've got like John Williams' score just escalating in the background, you've got their faces and just that sheer look of, and then, you know, Richard Attenborough goes, "Welcome to Jurassic Park," and it's just like, oh, this is going to be good. You said the gates, Pete.
The gates, when the gates open and they go through, just for some reason, just maybe more, you know, on repeat viewings because I know what's coming up, but for me that just rises the anticipation levels every time. There's something special about it, which as we'll discuss later in Jurassic World, has the same effect again then. So something about that moment, and obviously John Williams' theme, always.
I think that's a very underrated theme, isn't it? The Jurassic Park. I mean, you know, John Williams has created the best Hollywood themes, I think, in history, collectively. But, you know, people, they forget that with, you know, Indiana Jones, Superman, you know, all these different...
Star Wars, obviously.
And I think people sometimes forget, oh, yeah, Jurassic Park's also got a really iconic...
It is iconic.
I think that's a way to describe the whole film, really, isn't it? It's just, it's pop culture iconic in so many ways,
you can always tell because there's so many moments that bled through into other films and other, you know, elements of pop culture, and it started there, all of it. Even something as simple as the obvious, the water, the rumblings in the water, the ripples.
That's my moment. That's my moment of just like, you know, goosebumps. It's the water. It's the. It's that. Oh, when I went to see it again in the cinema a few years ago, I had the same experience. I was sitting there with two of my best friends. We were all roughly the same age. We'd all seen it when we were kids, and we were just there, just, you know, just gripping the seat, going, "Oh my god, this is so good." I think that and possibly the bit that always gets me is the bit at the end when they're running out of the big like display room with the dinosaur bones. And the T-Rex is in there, and it just roars. And then when dinosaurs ruled the earth, just falls over it. That bit gets me as well, because it's just signature. Mm. That's the whole point, really. Mm. I think. I think it's a clever film though as well. I think it's saying more under the surface than just a big adventure, you know, blockbuster, which of course it is. I think there's a little bit more down there, don't you? A bit more of a layer.
Hmm. About the dangers of playing God, really, isn't it? Mm. Measuring things you don't really understand, which is, it's obviously something it's played on across all the series, but I think it's handled best in the first one.
Yeah.
It's voiced a lot more by in Malcolm in particular, doesn't it? It's the whole, my favourite line of the whole thing is, you know, we're so preoccupied with wondering if you could, you never stop to, you know, figure out if you should. That's a paraphrase, but yeah. That line is just it encapsulates everything about Jurassic Park in one line, doesn't it?
I think that's what I like a lot about it, because it is that whole thing of how, you know, that's, to be honest, that's the whole running theme of all the Jurassic Park films, really, isn't it? About these men who aren't respecting nature and who are just expecting these dinosaurs to do what they want and to be what they want, and then, you know, when they don't respect nature, it bites back at them. And it's that whole, you know, it's the moral argument as well about, like Jeff Goldblum says, you know, you just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And it's that whole ethical sort of argument that underpins everything else, which gives it a lot more depth, I think, Jurassic Park. It gives it that. And that obviously comes from Michael Crichton, you know, whose novel was quite different. It was a lot darker and a lot more, there was a lot more stuff about chaos theory in there and with Malcolm and stuff like that, which they have to just cut for the film because they want it to be a, you know, entertaining ride, which it is, but it's definitely got more depth than it could have done, than I think lesser filmmakers would have, you know, had it do, really. So it is a classic. I mean, there's no other way to describe it, I think. It's just a pure classic.
It's one of the defining films of the 90s, without a doubt. I mean, every decade has its core group of films, and I think without a doubt Jurassic Park is there in the 90s. It's one of the top tier, isn't it? Films you automatically think of when you think of the 90s.
Yeah, hugely. It's interesting though, because Spielberg actually only made this as part of a deal to make Schindler's List. The studio said, look, because he wanted to make Schindler's List, he'd been planning it, and they said, right, we'll let you make Schindler's List, but you first need to do Jurassic Park. And even though he'd been, you know, setting Jurassic Park up for a couple of years, and he was very interested in it, he saw it more as an exercise in filmmaking and in you know, in technical stuff than actually something that he was really invested in, like Schindler's List. And he was doing post-production on Jurassic Park while he was in, like, Poland filming Schindler's List. So it's why those two films came out the same year, pretty much. So that was to go from those two. I mean, you can't get more extremes, can you? You know, but I think it's just got the lot. I mean, to me, it is one of the best films of the 90s. It was the film, I think, that got me interested in movies. I think it was one of the films that I remember being a really seminal thing for me. It was the first film I remember seeing multiple times. It was the first films that I think, one of the first films that got me wanting to watch more movies. You know, I cannot overestimate how big a thing this was for me when I was a kid. It was my obsession for a long time. I just love watching it again. You know, it will always be one of my favourite films. And I think one of the best films, I'd put it in the top 100 films, to be honest, ever made, Jurassic Park. I really would. I think it's really great from start to finish. So that's a high accolade. Where can you go from there? I mean, you know,
top 50.
There's only top 50. Yeah. Thanks for that. But I fear there was only one way to go for Jurassic Park, but we'll get to that later. Okay, moving on. We're going to have a break from all the dinosaurs and all the Jurassic chat and talk film news, because it is another week and there has been news, and it's been an interesting week. Some interesting things happened this week. So, Luke, why don't you go first? What's your film news of the week?
Obviously, I think the big one recently is Sir Christopher Lee, sadly passing.
Mm.
Big loss. I think a lot of people felt that one. You know, he had a long run though, so it's something to celebrate, not really be sad about. You know, he did a lot of good work, a lot of big work. But you know, it wasn't just film. You know, I appreciated the music and the metal, and you know, I've been reading up on him recently in his military career and things like that. So I do think he's definitely one to celebrate, but it is a big loss to the industry.
Is he the actor with the most credits on IMDb? Is that just a myth?
I'm not too sure.
But I mean, he did have a 70-year career, so even if it's not true, it must be one of them.
He's got to have a lot.
It could be. I mean, I think he's got tons, because he was still working up until like now, until he died.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't not surprise me at all. Because he'd done all kinds of things over the years.
Yes.
He'd done TV, and he'd done films. And
heavy metal.
Heavy metal.
Yeah.
He was the oldest man to be in the Billboard charts as well.
Was he really?
Yeah. Because was that his 90th birthday that he released that album?
Wow.
Incredible.
Legendary. He's genuinely a remarkable man, I think. Had a remarkable life. I think someone described it as, you know, most of us will only do like a fraction in our entire life of what Christopher Lee did in his.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like the amount of things. I mean, one of my favourite facts, and there's tons of facts about him, but one of my favourite facts is that he was in the SAS, and he can't talk about what he did. even now, he was asked, and he says, "I can't talk about any past, present, or future operations. Just know that, like, I was in it and that's it," which makes me think that he was involved in some serious shit back in the day. You know, he was probably there in Hitler's bunker, do you know what I mean? It's just like, it makes you wonder.
To be fair, if you were an enemy agent and they sent Christopher Lee after you, you would just go, "Fair play, hands
you'd
up,
just hear that
take
voice
me.
And you'd be like, "Yeah, I'm just not
Dracula's after fire. Me
I'm going."
It would be that kind of deep voice, you know, that kind of thing talking to you. You'd be like,
just a slight little footnote as well. His final role is actually coming out. It's a film he filmed last year, but it's coming out soon. And the name of the film escapes me now, but his actual part is the boss of the universe. I think he's just so fitting.
What a perfect way to go out. What a perfect way to end. Boss of the universe. Brilliant. I think a lot of people were affected by it, because he's one of those people I think you really thought was going to be around forever.
Yeah.
He was going on, and he wasn't, you know, he was still working, and he'd been in so many iconic things. I mean, obviously he was Dracula, you know.
Yeah.
He'd done things like Fu Manchu, he'd done all the Hammer films, he'd done, obviously he was Scaramanga, which is my favourite role he ever did. Not a good film, The Man with the Golden Gun, in my opinion, but he was brilliant all the way through.
Easily the best thing in that film.
Easily. And he wasn't even in much of it when you look back, actually. Yeah. He's only in like about half that film. Tops.
He's in All That Matters. All That Matters, you see.
All the bits that are good, he's in. You know, and it's that. Yeah. When I put a picture on Facebook of him at the dinner table when he's talking to Bond, and he says, Bond, you take just as much pleasure in killing as I do." And I always think of The Trip. I don't know if you've seen The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, because they do
yes.
that scene. And it's like, and they try and out-Bond each other and out-Scaramanga each other. Come as the Bond. They're drinking wine, getting more drunk. Come as the Bond. You take more pleasure than killing. It's great. I recommend that. but then, obviously, you know, things like Saruman the White and and then Count Dooku. I mean, say what you like about the prequels, they're shit. Say what you like about them. he was great, you know, I think, in those. And it's he could pretty much elevate, I think, anything he was in, really. Even when he was in shit, and he did a lot of shit, you know. He was good, so a great actor. Also, must be said, and it's a bit of a shame because this got slightly overlooked by Christopher Lee, but Ron Moody died as well on the same day.
Yes,
And obviously Ron Moody was Fagin in Oliver Twist. Mm. Another great old actor, another bit of a legend. Didn't make as much of an impact as Christopher Lee, but...
Who did?
Well, yeah, exactly. but one of those, you know, great old actors who'd done some really good stuff and was quite underrated, actually. And he was one of those people, I think, from what I've read since, he turned a lot down. I think if he'd have... I mean, he got the chance to play the Doctor, for instance, back in the 60s, and he said no, and he regretted that. I think had he not turned a lot more down, a lot more people would have known who Ron Moody was. But, you know, he was 91.
Yeah, so two nonagenarian actors dying in 1 week.
Very sad. So rest in peace, Christopher Lee and Ron Moody. There was a great exchange that Les Pitt, who's been on the podcast, put on Facebook about this. It was an imagined conversation between Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing in heaven, in which Peter Cushing says to him, so how did you leave them down there, Christopher? And he just replies, terrified. which I like. I think that sums it up, really.
Yes.
Pete, what's your news, anyway?
My news is a lot lighter, but yes, it's just a red bit of balance. It's casting news for the new Ghostbusters film. Obviously, with Paul Feig's Spy coming out last week, there's been a lot of press about Ghostbusters film that they're doing next year. And quite probably the first male cast member announced for it is Chris Hemsworth. He's been cast as the receptionist, which I think is brilliantly subversive. And there you go. I don't think he'll be playing Janine Melnitz, but you never know.
James Melnitz.
but yes, it's. I like Chris Hemsworth, and I like his comic timing. I think is underrated, so I think he'll be a good fit in whatever sort of presumably a small part in the film. But you know, it would seem to work well, and I've got more confidence about that film because I really like the Spy. So you know, I'm getting more and more, I don't want to say excited, but intrigued by it.
Yeah, same. I think that's a great bit of casting. I think it's a very shrewd piece of casting for Chris Hemsworth, actually. I think it's a very shrewd move because
playing with his image a bit.
Yeah, that film is going to be extremely successful. I mean, Spy, like you said, Spy's good. Spy's a good film. You know, we reviewed Spy last week. Spy's funny. It's got me a lot more excited for Ghostbusters. The very name of Ghostbusters is enormous. It's a franchise in itself. It will do well, despite whatever. You know, it will storm the box office. It's a shrewd move because it will allow him, like you said, to play comedy. Mm. And he is good at comedy because you couldn't play Thor the way it's played without being good at comedy. You know, he is. Mm. He's got that deadpan. A bit like Channing Tatum in that he's got that deadpan, you know, sort of delivery. Channing Tatum could play that part as well, I dare say, in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
It's that kind of... They both got
cut from the same cloth, aren't they?
They are a little bit, yeah. They're both cut from the same cloth. I think it's very clever. Very clever move. Nice piece of casting. How about you, Luke? Are you looking forward to Ghostbusters 3? Do you know much about it?
Not really. I'm not really looking forward to it. mainly because I'm not a fan of this big stunt thing of it's an all-female cast, and yeah, I'm just not really that interested. I'm not a massive fan of remakes and reboots, and I think this trend needs to stop. I'd much rather see original content than just rehashing what they know is going to sell tickets.
Well, it's interesting because this has been an ongoing debate lately, and it was something that we covered, I think, last week briefly, which is the fact that original films are not doing box office. Very rarely are they doing box office. And I was having this conversation with my housemates not long before recording, because we were talking about Jurassic World, which we'll get to later, but it has absolutely destroyed the box office this weekend.
Yeah.
It ridiculously. we'll talk more about that later, but it's this whole idea that, you know, if you compare that to Tomorrowland, which came out a few weeks ago, that has been a quite a flop for Disney.
Yeah, I think Disney said they were expecting $140 million loss on it, aren't they? Something like that.
It's ridiculous. It's getting up there with your John Carter kind of losses here. Now, again, John Carter was in a... it's based on a Victorian
series of novels in the early 1900s, isn't it? Edwardian stuff.
Edwardian.
It's that sort of timing, period.
So it's not necessarily original, but in comparison to franchises, it is. You know, but again, that did nothing. I mean, that wasn't a good film. But regardless, Tomorrowland's a better film than that. But the point is, people aren't going to see that stuff for some reason. And you know, for Tomorrowland, you can't accuse that of not having the right components. You know, it had a really good director, had a nice story. It had George Clooney, who's a box office draw. It's like, so where did it go wrong? So
Has it been an absolute box office smash that's not been an adaptation or a sequel or a reboot or anything of that kind since Inception? Because that's the last time I think there's been one. That's 5 years ago.
That would be interesting. If anyone knows that, tweet us or Facebook us and let us know, actually. Because that's a really interesting question, because I don't know the answer to that one. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I really can't. If anything, most of these things have made a loss. They broke even, or they've not done too badly. But they haven't titanically destroyed the box office.
The big hitters these days are established franchises, whether they're continuations or reboots or adaptations or something like that, aren't they?
But even more so than usual. I mean, it's like something's changed to the point where people just are not going out to see the cinema for anything that they don't already know or have a built-in relationship with, you know. And it could be the proliferation of the cinematic franchise that's caused this problem, because now you've got so many franchises, not just sequels, not just, you know, the odd double film or the odd trilogy like The Matrix. You've actually got now... I mean, if they were doing The Matrix now, The Matrix would have been about 9 or 10 films with lots of spin-offs from, like, you know, Morpheus would have got his an origin film. Do you know what I mean? It would have been... That's what would have happened.
I would so love it to be more cool about Agent Smith, just called Smith.
We laugh about it, but it probably would have happened. Smith, the movie. We're at a point now, I think, where people, they want some kind of already built-in ongoing narrative connective tissue story or something that has a history to it. It's quite scary, really, because I don't know where it's all going to end, really. I do. People won't get green light to make anything original anymore. That's where it will end, and that your big films, original films, will have no budget anymore. You know, you won't get films like Tomorrowland made because nobody will fund them. Or if they make them, they'll have to be massively scaled down, and they won't be what was intended to be, which is sad.
What do we need to be a big superstar director to get a huge cast together and just shoot for it? I mean, but Avatar is the obvious one there. I mean, that's still the box office, the box office smash of all time, isn't it? And that was original in 2009. So it is possible. It just needs something, you know, monstrous like that, something that's new, innovative, in ways people have never seen before.
With Avatar, though, I think you can't underestimate the 3D impact there. I
mean, that's what I'm suggesting, maybe, as well. Where, it needs something different, and that was different in its day.
I think I may have an answer to the question, actually, that you earlier posed. Interstellar.
Wasn't that big of a smash, though? Wasn't it like a monster smash, was it?
Interstellar made nearly $700
million. Did it?
So, yeah.
I didn't realise it made quite as big a... dent in my box, because it did then.
That's possibly with you know, on demand Blu-ray,
I suppose,
afterwards.
Yeah, I suppose.
$672 million. So
that's a lot better than I thought it did.
That's a lot of money, you know, for one. But again, the reason is you've got Nolan, and he assembled a cast who are at the top of their game in terms of popularity. Matthew McConaughey has just got an Oscar. He's a massive name now. People will go to see him, you know, and then it had a really good cast. It's got Nolan. It just had a hell of a lot of buzz behind it. So yeah, you've got to have, I think, that now, really. We're in an age now where the director has become as big a name as a star now, if anything bigger. You know, there are only a few actors in Hollywood now where you can genuinely put the name above the film and the name will sell the film.
I think we've got one now, certainly, coming out of it last week.
Well, yeah.
Vermit, yes. It's only cycles, though, because, I mean, you know, in the 40s and 50s, directors were God anyway. I mean, obviously Hitchcock and John Ford and directors like that were obviously huge, weren't they? David Lean, etc.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think
so. It's going back round. Yeah,
I agree. I think you're absolutely right. I think it has come back to that. I think the days of the big actor carrying the films are largely gone. You know, you like I say, there's only a handful. You could probably Tom Cruise, probably
Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, probably Robert Downey Jr.
Jennifer Lawrence these days, I think.
Maybe, but then she I don't know. I think she, most of the time she's done. Most of what she's done has been relatively on big films, but they're ensemble. You know, I mean, yeah, The Hunger Games, I guess, but I don't think that's her. I think that's The Hunger Games because that's the books. Mm. I don't know about that. Possibly.
We'll have to see Chris Pratt in films that aren't franchise based to determine his stuff.
If anyone can think of any other big films that are bucking this trend, do let us know. Do let us know. It's a really interesting topic. I dare say we will revisit this at some point. So that's the news for this week. That's a few snippets of news. Let's get on with let's get back to dinosaurs. Again,
the impression is not improving.
It's not improving, is it? I'm hoping it will throughout the podcast.
It's getting worse through time, which is going to get slightly better again 22 years later.
Okay, well, we're going to move on and take a look at the second Jurassic Park film, The Lost World.
Mummy! Daddy! I found something!
A British family on a yacht cruise stumbled upon Site B.
Now it's only a matter of time before this lost world is found and pillaged.
Hopefully we've kept this island quarantined and contained, but I'm in shock about all this.
Wow.
Isn't it great? Ooh, that's how it always starts. But then later there's running and then screaming.
Yeah, came out in 1997. Steven Spielberg back on board. The basic idea is that there was a second island. There was another. Instead of it being a park, but it's basically, well, instead of being a zoo, this is a safari park in essence, isn't it? It's where the dinosaurs are out to roam free. Things go wrong, as is usually the case. Richard Attenborough's character John Hammond sends for Ian Malcolm again, good old Jeff Goldblum, to basically go and sort things out with a motley crew, including a team of big game hunters for reasons best explained by plot. Jeff Goldblum is also convinced to go by the fact that his ex-girlfriend his current girlfriend, I believe, and his teenage daughter are also there in a plot device lifted from Dinner's Last Crusade. But never mind. So things go down, people die. T-Rex gets captured and taken to San Diego, and the film goes badly wrong from then on. Mm. As it morphs into a really bad Godzilla knockoff. Despite what you may have got from a sort of slightly sarky aside, there are some good points to it. I really liked Pete Postlethwaite in particular, who plays the chief big game hunter, Rowan Tembo. He is, whenever he's on screen, he electrifies it. Particularly the opening really moment, you see all these hunters in full form just blasting away at dinosaurs as they're roaming free, and when, unfortunately, you know, spoilers, he doesn't make it to the end of the film. When he does leave the island, it's just very Survivor-esque, isn't it? When he does leave the island there. That would have been better, actually. Dinosaur meets Survivor, but yeah.
Yes.
When he does go, the film takes a nosedive from there. Goldblum's great as ever. Richard Schiff is in it, which I think is fantastic. He doesn't
that.
Do anything, but he's in it. There's a few good action sequences. A few bits of Spielbergian touches, but then like I say, it all goes really badly wrong towards the end, and you just have T-Rexes stomping around the suburbs of San Diego, which is just a bit daft, and it all falls apart. It's a was apparently based off a Michael Crichton novel, which was a sequel to his original one. I haven't read that, so I don't know how much of it was taken from it, but I can't believe the second half of it was.
Yeah. I think the problem with this one is, I mean, it was written by fan demand for a start. Crichton wasn't going to do a sequel.
Yeah.
And the fans said to him, oh, do another one, because we love Jurassic Park the film, we want another film. And he was like, oh, go on then, if I must. He knew a cash cow when he saw it, but it was written in sort of tandem with the scripts. Mm. But the problem is, for me, this isn't really a Steven Spielberg film. You know, it doesn't fit him, almost, because it's not that kind of... Steven Spielberg is great at two things, and we'll talk more about this later, I dare say, but he's great at films that have deep meaning and can be very, like, serious and based on, you know, emotion and things like that, and actual world events. And then he's brilliant at action adventure and, you know, escapism. What he's not good at, and what he doesn't fit, is almost like corporate conspiracy monster thriller. And that's effectively what this is. I wrote a review of this, and I put, you know, it's the whole high concept classic blockbuster thing again. If you can sum up the story of Jurassic Park in one line: dinosaurs escape from a dinosaur-based theme park. Simple. That's effectively what it is. What's the actual one-line through line of The Lost World? Can either of you do it? What is it? What's the story of this film?
Dinosaurs in Jungle Island get captured and deposited to San Diego for no reason.
Right. Okay, that's probably in its basic form. Scientists sent to island to categorise dinosaurs, but another team goes to the island to kidnap them and put them in an amphitheatre as part of a conglomerate plan. Exactly. Do you see what? See the difference? Right. Even in the third one, you can say family attempt to rescue their son from dinosaur preserve. Yeah, you can even do it with the third one. I mean, that's not really a great film.
Dinosaur preserve just sounds like a make of jam.
jam. But, you know, so it's the whole thing of, I think, when you can't actually do that with a script and with a story, you've got a problem. You've got a fundamental problem. And I think it's a very baggy film. You know, it goes around the houses. It doesn't really, you know, it doesn't have an exciting through line. It does have its moments. It's like you said, there are some well-directed sequences. The one that stands out for me is roughly halfway through, smack bang halfway through the film, where their trailer goes over a cliff edge and they're hanging
out. Yes.
That is the best moment. That is far better than anything else in this film, because it's really well directed. It's tense as anything. And it's just 5 minutes of pure... I mean, it's as good as anything in Jurassic Park for me, that sequence. But that's it. The rest of it is very by the numbers, as you say. The characters aren't nearly as interesting. Poor Jeff Goldblum. He really is not a leading man in this kind of film. As The Fly proved, he can do a leading man perfectly.
I love that
well.
Film.
Great film. He's nothing. I'm not. I mean, Jeff Goldblum makes any film better for me. But in this film, he is not a leading man. All the stuff that made Ian Malcolm great in the first film has to go in order for him to be a leading man.
He's being a Malcolm Grant hybrid, isn't he? He's being Malcolm Grant.
Malcolm Grant, yeah. And it doesn't work. He's not got that sort of sly, you know, flirty, you know, slightly arrogant cleverness to him. He's just a dad who is trying to save his daughter while getting exasperated by everyone else and running around a lot. It's like, well,
the only bit where he is the same character is actually in his introduction when Hammond beats him again. When that great line, he says, "I'm not making the same mistakes last time." No, you're making all new ones.
Yeah,
that is great.
That's when you get the classic Jeff Goldblum way of talking, which is to do lots of sentences and then stop and think about it. So, John, are you really going to go to the island and do all those things? You must be crazy. I love the way he speaks. It's great. But yeah,
after that opening scene, and it just becomes, like I said, he's half Malcolm and half, Grant, isn't he? It's not...
I think you're completely right, and it doesn't work. You know, you can't make a sarky mathematician into a leading man in an action film. Yeah, it doesn't work. It just
wait till the sequel to The Theory of Everything.
The one where Stephen Hawking gets bionic legs and has to go and chase dinosaurs. I'd watch that, actually. as un-PC as that would be.
If that makes you any to be surprised.
But yeah, it's disappointing. I mean, I think it's, if not Spielberg's worst film, then it's one of them. And it's a shame because it's not really his fault, really. He does try, but
he
even his
elements, but it's a bland film from Spielberg, and yeah. He doesn't normally do bland.
It drags. It goes on, you know. And even he has admitted that it got away from him. And while he was filming, he said that, you know, he felt like it was, he didn't know what the core and the emotion and the soul of that film was. He said, I was making it and I was thinking, well, what is this really? And I think he's...
Because there isn't.
Exactly, because there isn't. It's just... Like you're saying, when you get to the end and it's just dinosaurs on
it's San a bad Diego. Godzilla movie, isn't it? It's a bad Godzilla movie.
It's just like, oh, this isn't nearly as cool as you think it would be. And, you know...
I like the idea of it being in the jungle. That was a good development, because I thought sort of the first one was the dinosaurs in the human world, versus humans in the dinosaur world. I think that's a nice change. But then it's dinosaurs in another human world, but, you know, in a town. It's not scary or as creepy or anything. It's just, oh, look, there's a T-Rex going past my window.
Yeah, that is all it is. And, you know, you don't really believe any of it. And it's just all a little bit pointless, really.
Why San Diego? I know, because it's a massive zoo, but you take it to New York or Los Angeles. If you go to America, you take it to a big city where there's stuff people recognise. There's no in San Diego.
Maybe it was cheaper to film there. Who knows?
I'm guessing it's because of the zoo, but even then.
Yeah. Luke, are you a fan?
It's not my least favourite out of the four.
That's
my favourite, but it's not a massive improvement. There was just something lacking in it. Like, I think, you know, like you're saying, with Spielberg not understanding what the film was, but then the cast as well. I don't think the cast that interested. Like, since obviously the release, Julianne Moore said she only did it because she needed to pay off the divorce settlement, and you know, it was just very. This is going to make money, so we'll do it.
It's interesting what you say about your reactions, because it's. On paper, you see, it's got a really good cast, hasn't it? I mean, Jeff Goldblum, Julianne Moore, I mean, Vince Vaughn, he can be okay. Pete Postlethwaite, as we say, was great, but...
Vince Vaughn, before he basically self-destructed his entire career.
Before he ballooned, before he discovered...
Before he put the weight on.
Before he put the weight on, probably because he knows he's making shite, so he just eats to make himself feel better.
You were saying that the scene in the trailer, when the trailer goes over the edge, that's obviously my favourite scene from it. I think it's one of the only good... like action set pieces in it that actually worked. And then I really like the opening as well, just because I love that snotty posh English girl being attacked. Because, like, I'm not being funny, but if I saw a big, well, quite a large herd of lizards walking on two legs, I wouldn't be feeding it a roast beef sandwich. I'd be screaming for help a lot sooner.
You'd fucking run, wouldn't you? You'd like, stupid little cow. I do agree about Postlethwaite, though, definitely. And there's that moment when you first meet the character where he basically turns around to Arliss Howard and goes, right, I will do this for you, but I want to hunt a T-Rex, and I'm not going to tell you why, it's my business, just do what I want. And it's just a brilliant moment where
this guy means business.
He means business. Unfortunately, he's completely wasted after that, and he really is for the most part.
I love a bit when it's the first hunt and you see him just absolutely loving this. He's just taking pop shots at
Spielberg called Postlethwaite after filming this, actually, the greatest actor in the world. It is hard to refute that, actually. At the time, you know, he was definitely one of the greatest actors, I think, out there. So, and he does. It's just a shame that he doesn't get more to do, and he doesn't get, like, you know, not even he can really save this, which is a bit of a shame. I just think it was a real misfire, and it's just, by this point, kids and everybody had become obsessed with dinosaurs, so it was always going to do well at the box office, and kids would have been happy with it enough, because there was dinosaurs in it, and they were, you know, but critically, I thought it was bollocks even then, and my opinion hasn't changed in 15, 16, well, nearly 20 years, actually. So, thumbs down for The Lost World, I think. We're going to move away again from the dinosaurs, and just quickly, we're going to talk about the current box office figures for the UK, which are always interesting. This is for the weekend of the 5th to the 7th of June, so previous weekend to the one we're recording on. And we're going to go down at number 10, falling rapidly actually, in 2 weeks, is Man Up, which has made a million, that's all.
It's only had a limited release, though, hasn't it? Relatively speaking, I mean, in this era of multiplexes and things, it's not really...
No, this is 306 cinemas.
Really?
So that's a fairly... It's a fairly wide release. It's been in Cineworlds and things like that, so it's done nothing really at the box office. It's debuted halfway up, and I'm not surprised it hasn't done much, but I think it would still probably be considered a flop, even so. At number 9, now...
Yes, good luck.
I'm going to mispronounce this. It's a Bollywood film, all right. It's a Bollywood film. It's called Dil Dada Karni Do, I think. I don't know what that film's about at all, but it's a Bollywood film, and you know, there is definitely a market for that. So
I'm always impressed, because I've never been involved or interested in Bollywood, because I just don't understand it. But they always seem to do well at the box office.
They definitely have a fan base. Well, that's made just over 200,000. At number 8, this is a little bit of a cheat, I suppose, but it's
yes.
The Empire Strikes Back, but obviously the Empire Strikes Back hasn't had a release, you know, nationwide. This is purely from the Secret Cinema event in London, so it's just one screening, and it's made £304,000 already, and this is over one weekend. I mean, the reason is that the tickets are £75 a pop, so they're counting the £75 as the it is a cheat. If it keeps going like this would be top of the box office, like, you know, very
probably cheap. not this week.
I'm surprised they're counting it, to be honest, because it's a bit of a cheat.
You went to that, didn't you, Tony?
I did, and I actually probably can't tell you much about it, because you do have to sign a confidentiality.
Yes, it is very it's secret, isn't it?
Is why I haven't reviewed it actually properly, because I know I'd give too much away.
There's a lot more to it than just the film.
Suffice to say, it's a genuine immersion into the world of Star Wars, and it's marvellous. I mean, it's completely worth the money. It's a lot of money, but it's really worth it. It's a fantastic experience, and it's all night. You know, it's a good 5 hours experience. And I went with my mates Lee and Matt, and Lee brought with him a small R2-D2 with him, like a baby sized R2-D2, which actually speaks. And, you know, it responds to commands. So you say, hey, R2, and it goes, and does the head turn. So kids were loving that, because it was being quite surly. So because the batteries were powered down. So at times it wasn't responding. It was just going, like that. And then...
It was being R2.
Yeah, and when Lee would turn to it and go, you don't want to know R2, do you? He'd just shake his head and go, brilliant. But no, wonderful, wonderful experience. I would recommend it to anyone. It's especially if you go there and you're not a Star Wars obsessive, you might be a little bit, you know, it might be a bit too much for you. But if you love Star Wars, it's unlike anything else. So, and obviously, Empire Strikes Back is a great film. And number 7, Tomorrowland, which in its third week has now made it's made 4 million, nearly 5 million, which isn't too bad. So it's not done too bad. It probably would have done a lot more had it got good word of mouth and everything, which I don't think it really has. At number 6, still in there, is Avengers, Age of Ultron. That's made 47 million now, at just in our box office alone, which is...
When is it going to drop out of the top 10? It's going to be a month, 2 months.
It's in its 7th week, and it's still showing at cinemas, so I wouldn't be surprised if they keep it rolling over the summer holidays as well, to get some more kids go back and watch it.
Well, it'll probably float up again when Ant-Man comes out, won't it? So.
Yeah, possibly. I think it'll break 50 million at some point, which is great. At number 5, dropping a couple of places is Pitch Perfect 2. In its fourth week, it's made 16 million. It's not bad, it's not doing too badly.
Good real run, hasn't it? Really?
Yeah, it's a good little run. It's certainly made enough globally to that there are already talks about the third film, which delights
Don't
me.
Do it.
I loved it. No, I love Pitch Perfect. I love both. Well, I love the first one. This one is good.
No.
But I love them.
Anna Kendrick, she's just adorable. She really is.
And they're just nice films. But yeah, Luke, you're not a fan of Pitch Perfect.
Loved the first one. Second one was meh. And the third one, if they do it, I think it's just going to go down again. And I'd rather have the good memories than, well, it was good, but then look what's happened. And it's, yeah. It's a strange one, because that's normally the type of film that I really love and I'd be championing all the way.
Is this a similar scenario to say if it's going to be, I mean it probably won't be, but if it's a sequel to Mean Girls comes out, one that's actually, you know, a proper release, not just a sort of quick
I don't think it's
lightning
an idea
in a bottle
that is big enough to have multiple sequels. I think it should have just been a self-contained solo film. A lot of what was good about the first one was lost in the second one, I thought.
Just be glad it's not Sony behind it, otherwise they'd try and build a cinematic universe around it, because they're desperate to have one.
Oh, they'll just reboot it in 3 years, and then 3 years later they'll reboot it again, and then reboot it again like they're doing with Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You just have a separate franchise for each cheerleading team throughout the United States, and then have a big crossover at a cheerleading arena.
It would not surprise me.
Sony and Matt.
I think there's room for a third. I think a third would really be it. I mean, that you couldn't do any more than that. There's definitely room for a third film. I mean, as soon as I walked out, I could see the plot of the third film already, you know, in my head. You know, it's easy enough to figure out. So then by the sound of it, they're definitely going to do it. So, you know, that's good, because it's a nice film. At number four, still in there, wonderfully in its fourth week, Mad Max Fury Road. This has made 15 million now, which is a good take, so it's done well. Film of the year so far for me. Nothing has come close to beating it.
I was about to say the same. I was about to say exactly the same. It's my film of the year by a country mile.
Yeah, nothing so far has touched the sides of that, so I'm hoping some stuff will.
There's a couple of films coming out towards the back end of the year that might have a chance, but for now.
If it's not in my top five of the year, I'll be pretty amazed. Wonderful film. And number three, Insidious Chapter 3, which Ian...
One end of a scale to the other, right there.
Ian destroyed it. In fact, speaking of that, you can, if you go to Zeddemore Rants on YouTube, you can see Ian Austin do more of an in-depth rant about Insidious Chapter 3. So I do recommend you pop and give him a look. That has made nearly 1.5 million though, so it's, you know, it's made... Not bad money.
Usual teenage crowd for any horror film that comes out, isn't it?
But I don't think it will last much longer. I think it will sink pretty fast.
If it's top five next week, then I'll be very surprised.
I agree. And number two, San Andreas, with The Rock versus Nature in its second week.
The Rock versus Rocks.
The Rock versus Rocks. That's made 8.5 million, so that's a big hit, and it will probably stay in there for a while yet.
Surprise her, because it's nothing groundbreaking.
Ah, very good. Very good.
I'll be here all week.
I think you're actually on a technical point right, though.
It is true. It's a good old standard disaster movie. Probably been made about 1975, and you went to brush in an eye of it.
Yeah, it's an old Irwin Allen, just with a bit of cherry on top, really. But it's got The Rock, and anything with The Rock deserves a bit of attention. At number one, though, inevitably, in its first week, in is Spy at 2.5 million. So it's made done a good growth this weekend. I think Spy will hang about there for a couple of weeks at least. I thoroughly enjoyed Spy. Like I said last week, I thought it was great fun. It's not perfect. It's a bit overlong. Its plot goes a bit round the houses sometimes, and Miranda's pointless, but the rest of it...
That's just a general viewpoint in general,
but especially in the film. I think overall it really made me laugh a lot.
Plus, Statham.
Statham. He's a joy to behold.
I want Statham just to go off down that route of being much about Chris Hemsworth earlier, but playing against type and being more comedic seems to work for Statham.
I think, yes, but as long as he doesn't do it too often. I think every now
and then... That's the point of parody, but...
Yeah. Every now and then, yeah, maybe go off and do something. I mean, if they do a... Well, say if... When they do a Spy 2, and I'm sure they will, you know, get him
spies.
Back...
You know, sure, spies. Sure, yeah, spies. Yeah,
must be. I'm sure they will probably do a sequel, because it's done quite well at the box office. But yeah, I think he's... The thing is, he's always been good at this. I mean, if you go back to Snatch... I mean, he was really funny in Snatch, playing like a slightly sort of what the fuck kind of villain, kind of a gangster. You know, he's always had that edge of comedy to him. But yeah,
the Transporter films. I mean, the first one really, but yeah,
it's definitely a bit of a dry wit in there. I agree. So yeah, that's the box office. Expect Jurassic World to trample its way. Oh, it's really good there. To trample and roar its way into the. Into the top of the charts next week, but we'll examine that when we're back.
We'll chew into it, shall we?
Chew into it next week. Yeah. Speaking of, let's chew into the next of the dinosaur.
No, it isn't.
I'm determined. We'll chew into the next Jurassic film, and this is Jurassic Park 3.
I have a proposition I'd like to discuss with you. I've chartered an airplane to fly us over Isla Sorna, and we'd like you to be our guide. We'd love to make a contribution to your research here.
It could almost be paradise.
I got it forgotten.
We have a landing strip up here.
You cannot land on this island.
Oh my God!
But in this forbidden place, where man has tampered with nature...
This is how you make dinosaurs?
This is how you play God.
Something unexpected has evolved.
Yeah, the first one to not be based on a book or have Spielberg behind it, and which obviously really shows. Basically, opens up with a man and a boy parasailing around this island, which, you know, what's going to go wrong there? get lost on the island. So his parents hire the protagonist of the first film, Sam Neill, to fly around the island only. They won't land, they'll just fly around. They land.
And, this is shocking me. I mean, you know.
There's three big things missing from this one. Michael Crichton, Steven Spielberg, and T-Rex. You know, arguably the most well-known dinosaur, and it's a Spinosaurus that's the big dinosaur from this one.
Steven Spielberg was involved on a production level, in fairness. He was the executive producer, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Joe Johnston was a director, wasn't he? He's a darn good director at certain things. The Rocketeer and Captain America, obviously. But...
This film had three writers, but it doesn't have an ending.
It doesn't have any, you're right, it doesn't at all.
They went into production and they started filming before the script was even finished, and that definitely shows that it was just like, oh, so what do we do now, and then it ends, you know, you're at the end of your 90 minute runtime and they just leave the island. It's obviously similar to previous films, but yeah, I don't like the ending to this one at all. It builds up to this, you know, I think it has the great chase of the Spinosaurus following them throughout the film, but then they just kind of peter out about 15 minutes before the end, where you fire a flare at some water and it just swims off. And then you have the Velociraptor at the end with the eggs, and Sam Neill blows on a computer-made larynx. And obviously that means that the raptors understand what he's saying, and he's saying the exact right thing to them. And they just take their eggs and leave, and then they run to the beach and get on a boat. There's no ending to it at all.
I love the Universal Translator for Velociraptor edition. I really do. I'm surprised that didn't take off in toy stores up and down the country.
it's a weird film, this, because it's... I mean, it came about, I think, partly because when
money.
This film was made... Well, yeah, money, mainly. But when the first one was made, Joe Johnson actually said to Spielberg to do the second
one. Sequel.
And, yeah, and then he said, well, no, I want to direct that. I mean, what a that stupid choice there, Steve. But, like, I mean, he pretty much probably knew there'd be another one because he was going to make money. And he said
he could do the third. Yeah,
he said, you can do the third one if we ever make it. So that was probably another factor towards it. And it's the whole thing of, well... Yeah, you can totally tell that they didn't finish the story. It went they spent $18 million, actually, on pre-production of a completely different story, which they then junked 5 weeks before they were going to start filming because it didn't work. So then they brought back David Koepp, who wrote the first and second, partly the second films.
No, completely the second and partly the first.
Yeah.
There
you go. And... So they got him back involved.
No, Tammy, good move in that case, if he was responsible for the second one.
Well, exactly. And then they came up with this rescue plot, you know, which in theory, you know, I mean, it's
the same for it.
Well, I'll say this for it. It's got more of a streamlined idea than the second one. You know, it's not baggy like that. It's half an hour shorter for a start. I mean, I'll give it its due. It gets in and gets out, you know, quickly. Problem is, like you say, Luke, it doesn't end properly.
No, it would have been an hour and 45 minutes if it had an act three.
If it had an act three, you're absolutely right. It just ends, and it's
Bourne Legacy syndrome, is what I call that.
Yeah, definitely. It's that similar kind of thing. Oh, is that it? And you wonder what the point was. I mean, all the way through this, I was thinking, well, it feels like if they made a Jurassic Park TV series, this would be a two-parter. Or maybe even just a random single episode, you know.
Come back next week. Come back next week for more dino rampaging fun.
Right, and it's just like, and it has none of the satire or the subtext or the.
No, it was, you know, darker than the first two.
It seems like people have just sort of cooked it up in a sort of meth lab for dino plots, where they've just thought, what worked in the first one? What worked in the second one? Let's mush it together and create a new story.
Yeah.
And you know, creating something new like that might not always work, but it doesn't matter because it strips away the humanity behind it, in my view. But particularly in the first one, the second one, I've watched, but it just sort of went dinosaurs, yay!
Well, what it's trying to do is,
are they going to have a T-Rex?
Well, yeah, no T-Rex. But what it's trying to do is keep that theme of family going. You know, that's been something they've tried to do throughout the whole of the Jurassic Park, and it's very Spielberg. I mean, Joe Johnson is basically, you know, a Spielberg wannabe, effectively. I mean, he's a good director, and he's an underrated director, actually. But he's very much in the mould of Spielberg. Yeah, and he's very pulp. And it's that kind of, you know, they keep that idea about the family. But the problem is, the other films had this underlying idea of subtext in terms of, you know, it was the villains in the all the other Jurassic Park films, and I include Jurassic World in this, are not the dinosaurs. The villains are the stupid humans, right, around it. Now, there's none of those. You could argue that the parents are a bit stupid, but they're not bad guys. You know, the bad guy here is the Stegosaurus, I think it is, or the, you know, whatever it is, the Spinosaurus.
Yeah.
And the dinosaurs aren't supposed to be the villains. The dinosaurs are just the monsters who, you know...
They're heavies.
You could argue that the Indominus Rex is a villain, obviously, but it there's a difference. You know, they're just doing what they're doing. They're just carnivores that are
eating things.
But in this, it's set up that is the baddie, you know, and it's like, well, you're missing the point of the whole thing. Exactly. This just doesn't have a point to it.
You know, the weird thing is, this is actually less a Jurassic Park film and closer to Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World, as in the novel. And then just people turn up. Yeah, people turn up to a place where there's dinosaurs, which is what it is, rather than the whole, you know, creation and the whole aspect of mad scientists and stuff, which is what Jurassic Park is.
I think this is a better film than The Lost World, but I think The Lost
I can't say that.
Only just, and I think that, you know, only the fragment. I think because it's streamlined, because it actually.
Sam Neill's a better reading man.
Sam Neill is a much better leading
man. As much as I love Jeff Goldblum. I love Jeff Goldblum, and he's my favourite actor in the entire Jurassic Park franchise, but Sam Neill's a better leading man.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that helps to have him back. And it's, you know, so I will give it its due that it's slightly better, but what at least The Lost World had a standout sequence and had the undercurrent of commentary to it again. I think Jurassic Park 3 is a little bit of a misstep, really.
The other thing that's never mentioned, this... the three pteranodons that fly away at the end, like, Did they not find civilization? Did they just happen to find another abandoned island and live there happily ever after?
Well, I was thinking about that, because aren't they deadly?
Yeah.
Well, we've seen it in the fourth one.
Yeah.
You can't just be left just to flap about and
I was hoping it'd be mentioned fourth one, but I mean, no. I'm glad they ignored it. But
well, I mean, let's face it, I think Jurassic World kind of just decides that it's going to be the second sequel, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it really does sidestep these two films, and probably for the good, for the better.
Yeah.
Was saying that doesn't exist, a miscontinuity now.
I think it kind of, in a way, it doesn't. I think really, yeah, I think Jurassic Park 3...
It was Iwasauna, wasn't it? For me, it was Iwasauna.
Yeah,
Iwasauna.
New...
Yeah, it was Iwasauna. It's the same in the second. Yeah.
Just because you can't afford to build the sets again, so let's stick it on the island a bit, or where was
that? It's the whole thing they're doing with Alien 5, isn't it? That's like a follow-on from Aliens. Let's just disregard the ones that people don't like, and we'll follow up what everyone likes.
I think as well, the one thing I must mention as well is how bad Taya Leone's acting is in this
film.
God. And there's that one scene where she sees the skeleton of the guy, and her reaction, it is hilarious. The overacting she does is... No wonder she got nominated for a Golden Raspberry. It's probably for that moment alone.
It'd been better if she'd done a raspberry at that point.
Yes, I think it would have been. It's just, oh my god. You know, let's just pretend Jurassic Park 3 and The Lost World don't exist. Moving on, I'm going to introduce a new section now, which I'm going to do in recurring fashion whenever I'm hosting the podcast, which won't be too often, don't worry. And it's going to be called Director's Corner. And the idea is that it focuses on the filmography and discusses a specific director. And the idea will be that it will link to pretty much whatever we're talking about, ideally. So where better to start than the man himself, Steven Spielberg? So I'm just going to talk a little bit, well, we're all going to talk a little bit about Steven Spielberg and about his career. Steven Spielberg's an interesting director, really, because I think that when it was the so-called American New Wave, which had, you know, your Francis Ford Coppolas, your Martin Scorsese's, you know, your George Lucas's, your Spielberg. I think they're all huge names, but I think Spielberg is so synonymous with filmmaking of the last 30, 40 years. I think he's one of those people that you don't have to know anything about movies to know who he is. If somebody says Steven Spielberg, everyone will know that he directed probably Jurassic Park or Jaws or, you know, Schindler's List, or one of the films that, or Indiana Jones. They'll know more than likely who he is. And I think to actually sort of get to that point, you have to be somebody who's made such a massive impact on popular culture. And I think if you look back at the history of 20th century cinema, and I think if you track that, I think even more than Hitchcock, I think Spielberg will be the one who made the most kind of cinematic impact on pop culture.
Summer blockbuster. He invented the summer blockbuster.
Well, he did. I mean, you know, if you go right back to the very beginning, he started low scale. He started more on television, you know, and he was doing things like, you know, different shows like Night Gallery and just random shows like that. But it was the first thing he did for me, actually, is my favourite Spielberg. And it's...
Really?
I know it's not his best, but I think it's up there. I think it's in his top three or four. It's Duel, which... Duel is the film that nobody remembers. You know, everyone remembers Jaws as the first big Spielberg film. And it was. And it was the film that put him on the map and put blockbusters on the map. But Duel, for me, is a marvellous, phenomenal piece of work. It was made for television, based on a Richard Matheson story. But it was... It's just about a truck with a driver you never see that chases a businessman through the desert and tries to kill him. And it is 90 minutes of utter terror and tension. And it's one of the best directed things I've ever seen in my life. And it was like Jurassic Park, even before Jurassic Park, actually, when I was really young, when I was about 6 or 7, I remember watching it on television and I became obsessed with that film. Before I knew who Spielberg was, before I watched a lot of other films, I just was... I couldn't stop watching that, and it used to scare me to death. And even now, it chills me, you know.
It's like a long episode of Twilight Zone, isn't it?
Yeah, It really is. It's like it is. It's all like an Outer Limits or something. It's just it's a terrifying film. Because the tension is turned up to 11, and that's something that he was, you know, he's always been very good at. You know, when he gets to Jaws, and that's a very different kind of film. That's much more horror and horror based in many ways. But that was the first film that really just put the template out there for what would be an event film. And if anything, I think Spielberg, more than Lucas, actually invented that kind of event movie.
Yeah.
Because it's like placing it in the summer as well, because before Jaws, the summer was like a dead end, right? What we term like January, February now, that was the summer. It's like you just chuck any old film in the summer and, you know, no one will go because everyone's outside. And then Jaws appears, boom, changes the landscape.
Definitely, you know, and you know, it led then to, you know, films like, you know, Richard Donner with Superman and obviously then Star Wars, which, and you know, you can't take anything away from the fact that George Lucas created the biggest, you know, the biggest ever franchise and the biggest blockbuster. Don't get me wrong, but I know that. But in terms of impact, in terms of actual cinema, and not just like impacting pop culture, but quality as well, and the amount of different iconic things that was created, I don't think you can touch Spielberg in terms of that. Certainly not in that period, maybe from like 1975 to about 1995. That period when he was probably at his peak, and when he was probably
no doubt. It was just hit, wasn't it?
You know, it was. You know, after you know Jaws, it was Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Well,
and then you know it was, and then it was Raiders of the Lost Ark. There have been the odd missteps, like 1941, which was, an admirable failure. Let's put it that way, you know, and things like that. But you know, then when he did Raiders and then E.T. as well. I mean, E.T. My God, I mean, that may be the most sort of biggest pop culture film of the 80s, E.T., or one of them anyway. Everybody knows what E.T. is.
That's the most Spielberg film of Spielberg done, isn't it, lad? He's got everything Spielbergy in one package.
Yeah.
Family and you know, adventure and, you know, sort of poignancy and all the sort of things he brings to every film. He just squished it all together into a weird old squash-head alien. And it worked.
And he spent a lot of time doing those kind of films, and then when he did The Colour Purple in 1985, it showed the other flip side that he then has developed, and then he's pretty much ever since gone from one to the other, where he went from
popcorn
really
family to
friendly popcorn, like you say, where it's, you know, he went from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom to The Colour Purple. I mean, that you can't get more, you know, more of a contrast in terms of films.
Well, 1993, as we mentioned.
Exactly. With Jurassic Park and Schindler's List, it's that whole thing. So, you know, you've got somebody who is flipping between very weighty, dramatic, meaty material, and then who's actually doing stuff that's really popcorn and you know, exciting and adventure and everything like that. And it's, you know, that's a trend that carries on. You know, when you get to things like Hook, which was another film I was obsessed with. I mean, this is why Spielberg isn't my favourite director now. My favourite director is Stanley Kubrick. I think most people would love at least one Spielberg film, if not more. I'd be stunned if somebody hated everything Spielberg has ever done.
One side of the spectrum or the other.
Right, because, exactly, you may hate all his popcorn stuff, but I don't think anyone with a straight face could turn around and say Schindler's List is a bad film. I mean, you'd have to be an idiot, quite frankly. Right? It's just not a bad film. It is phenomenal. So then you've got that. And then you've got, you know, flipping from, like you say, Jurassic Park to Amistad, and then back again to, you know, things like, and then to Saving Private Ryan. I mean, think of this. I mean, think of the filmography. Almost everything he's ever done is a film that most people have seen, or most people have talked about or know about, or has hit some kind of nerve in pop culture, and has done so many different genres that have covered things to do with racism, with, you know, the Holocaust, with, you know, the slave trade, you know, to things like, you know, the Second World War. I mean, the whole Normandy landings thing that he did, which was just incredible, you know.
I hold up the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan is the best war depiction of all time. I mean, the only 20 minutes of that, the actual Normandy landing, the best depiction of war ever. by an absolute mile.
It's stunning. You know, it's just he really does often set the bar and everything like that. He's one of those directors who will happily just change. He's gone into all kinds of genres as well. You know, he had the spell in the early 2000s where he did things like AI and Minority Report, which I don't think were particularly great films, and I think he's not as comfortable in that kind of sci-fi, too sci-fi area.
I have a soft spot for Minority Report. I think that's a very underrated little film, man.
I wasn't a big fan of that one, but I can see why it's certainly, I think I'm in the minority. Most people really are in the Minority Report.
You're a minority.
I'm in a minority. didn't even intend that joke. But then, you know, I think really from the 2000s, I think he's become a little bit more hit and miss to an extent. I think
he's focusing more on being a producer to some extent these days, isn't he?
Yeah,
he isn't directing quite as much or quite as many big films as he used to.
No, not quite. You know, he didn't do as many in the 2000s. One he did do, which I think is very underrated, was The Terminal.
That Spielberg?
That was Spielberg.
I never realised that was Spielberg's, mate.
Yeah, and it got mixed reviews, but I really like that film. I think it's a very sweet movie, and I think
very un-Spielberg to a way, but also you can see. Yeah, I can see it.
There's that. Yeah. You know, and then things like Munich, which I thought Munich was very good. You know, not one of his greatest biopic kind of things. You know, serious films, but it was very good. But then it's interesting. Lately, he, like you say, he hasn't done that much. I think his last great film was probably Lincoln. In fact, I think that might have been his last film actually that came out. Well, and Lincoln was very good. So it's been interesting how, you know, his next film is now Bridge of Spies, which is another Tom Hanks, you know, Cold War kind of threat.
Yes.
So it's. That will be interesting to see. It's like written by the Coen brothers as well, so that could be wonderful.
Yes.
But he's one of these directors who I think has really sort of put that kind of stamp on cinema from roughly the 70s, I think, more than any other. Like you say, he's produced all kinds of things. You know, if you look back at a lot of the movies in the last 30 years, a lot of the well-known ones, even if he hasn't directed them, he's probably been involved in them. Poltergeist, Gremlins. There have been a lot, you know, of things, TV series that he's been involved with, and, you know, all kinds of things
odd,
like that.
Odd things he was a producer in. He was a producer of Men in Black and stuff like that. Is that Austin Powers?
Right, Men in Black, Austin Powers.
Transformers.
Transformers, yeah, you know, and all these kind of things that, they might all not be particularly great, but they have his name on them. All these things that people have responded to or gone to see or have become massive hits through DreamWorks. He's, you know, and Industrial Light and Magic and all these things. He's become that guy. Once you got into the era of, like, you know, your Godfathers and things like that, and then Jaws and then Star Wars. That was the point really where movies became more than just films. They became lifestyles for people. They became interest points. They became obsessions. Really, before then, that wasn't quite how it was. They were pieces of art, or they were things people would go and see for escapism. It was that point where people started to live their lives by things like Star Wars or Indiana Jones, or, you know, and it's through people like Spielberg who gave birth to that kind of, you know, devotion and immersion in cinema. And when I think about all the films I love and all the films that I grew up loving and all the childhood films, he is pretty much the one director who's done most of them when I think about it. So I think he's a genius in many ways. Yeah, and I think I think his contribution to cinema has been astronomical. I think without him, it would have been a lot less.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And speaking of him, he's an executive producer in the big one, the one we're here to talk about, Jurassic World.
We have learned more in the past decade from genetics than a century of digging up bones. A whole new frontier has opened up. We have our first genetically modified hybrid.
We just went and made a new dinosaur?
Probably not a good idea.
Almost 40 feet high. Really think she climbed out?
Depends.
On what?
What kind of dinosaur they cooked up in that lab?
Obviously, the newest Jurassic Park film. Not a reboot, not a remake. but let's just say sort of a sequel, I suppose, to the first film. Like we said before, it kind of just skips out the last two. And this is set back on Isla Nublar, the first island from the first film. And this is basically John Hammond's vision of Jurassic Park has become a reality. It's now Jurassic World. It's this glossy, super-duper theme park that has been created with tons of dinosaurs, with 2,000 people a day visiting. It's got attractions, it's got stores, it's got rides. It's the whole shebang, the whole thing that people have conveniently forgotten 20 years, people will eat you to death. And they built a dinosaur, you know, Disneyland, basically. And, you know, shocker, inevitably, a dinosaur gets loose and problems happen. Shocker.
Really?
I know.
That's a shame.
The Indominus Rex, which is a genetically modified dinosaur, which has been created because people need bigger attractions. They're not happy with T-Rexes. They're not happy with big, giant dinosaur fish things that leap up and eat sharks.
I do know the name of that one. That's a Mosasaur. Mosasaur. There you go.
Mosasaur. They're not happy with Mosasaurs.
Eating jaws.
Or whatever. Eating jaws. They want more. They want... And unfortunately, the scientists breed basically a nutcase of a dinosaur that decides, fuck this, I'm not going to be kept in captivity, I'm going to go out there and kill everybody. And starts killing for sport, not survival. So, gentlemen, what do we think of the new one?
I like what it mentioned in the title. I like the world they built.
Oh, yes.
I think the world was brilliant, and the dinosaurs were great, but the characters were not so great. They really let down by the characters. There wasn't anyone that kind of had the charisma of Malcolm, or I don't know, there was just lots missing. I think the 10 years it's taken to sort the plot out has just kind of left the characters at the bottom of the pile. And because obviously there's been so many writers involved and so many drafts and whatnot, it really does show that I didn't really care about any of them that died.
The dinosaurs had better characters than me.
Yeah.
I mean,
Blue had much more characterization. They had more development than pretty much all of the characters.
In the film. It's odd that the names that spring to mind from the film are, you know, apart from the lead, which is Chris Pratt, which is Owen Grady, the character names that spring to mind are Indominus Rex, Rexy, and Blue. And they're dinosaurs. Because they've got fully... I mean, in case of Indominus Rex, it's a complete insano. I mean, that's actually a sort of not a character arc as such, but it goes off down its own path, and Blue has a character arc. Suddenly you think, a Velociraptor has a character arc, and the humans don't. What's going on here? But, you see, I have to agree with you on a lot of your points. I think I love the setup of the actual Disney World, Jurassic World itself, as a sort of Disney World meets zoo with dinosaurs in it. All that was fascinating to me. I actually wanted to spend longer just wandering around it. Is it really wrong that I would still go to that park? I would have wanted to, if that park was actually open, I would go. I would go. Because it looks so cool. At least to me. I like zoos and theme parks and that sort of commercialised stuff.
It did look really good. Yeah.
I enjoyed that. I mean, that's a bit... it's a shame because I knew obviously it was all going to go to hell in a handcart, but I was a bit disappointed. Like, it was a little dinosaur petting zoo and I thought, oh, that's cute. Well,
I don't know how you guys saw it, but I saw it at IMAX 3D. The 3D didn't add anything at all. You know, the only reason I watched
3D... When does it? If it's not directed by James
Cameron. The only reason I watched 3D was because that was the only way it was shown at IMAX.
Mm.
But on IMAX, it was absolutely stunning. Obviously, everything's bigger and brighter, but I think it really did... It worked really good in IMAX, but the 3D was naff.
Well, I must quickly just rant about that slightly, because for some reason now... Well...
There's no IMAX 2D.
Oh, well, I was going to say, for some reason, we know why. Because no one's going to watch just 3D anymore, right? People are going to watch IMAX and 2D, but nobody wants 3D. So what they're doing is they're bolting 3D onto IMAX, so we don't have a choice. So the only way to watch IMAX is to watch it in fucking 3D, which is shit.
It's worth it for the IMAX. It's worth it for the IMAX. The IMAX experience is huge, and I love the IMAX. But
when I went to see Age of Ultron in IMAX 3D, I genuinely think I didn't enjoy that film as much because I was watching it in 3D. The IMAX was fine, right? It's because that film is so bloated with action. My eyes were just blurred by the end of it because there was just too much going on.
Did you also see Jurassic World in the same? Because that was, if anything, even more action.
Well, exactly, I didn't. I chose to just in 2D.
Fair enough.
I refuse to indulge this IMAX 3D bollocks that they're now foisting on us. I refuse. I simply refuse. There's a line in the sand. There is a line in the sand. I'm drawing this.
And it is around Birmingham.
It is around Birmingham. I've moated. It's a line of a moat. I've sectioned Birmingham off. I refuse.
People have been doing that for ages.
Yeah. And it's just. Yeah, I'm not surprised, Luke. I'm not surprised that that's the reaction you had.
Yeah.
You see, I love IMAX, so I'm willing to accept 3D in that sense for the IMAX. The IMAX gives it the scale I wanted. But Moses saw in particular, and that makes its entrance. That just blew me away. It was the size and scale of it.
I think with Jurassic World, the issue I had with this film, very similar lines to both of you, really, especially Luke. I think it was entertaining. I think it was fun. I won't lie, I did enjoy myself. There was plenty of incident, plenty of action. Chris Pratt was great fun. This was his Indiana Jones audition, and he passed with flying colours.
Even though he's playing a very stock character, but he just has enough inbuilt charisma to make it work.
That wasn't even the script,
I'm guessing. That's just him.
It's just him, right? We knew that from Star-Lord. Guardians, obviously, is a proper written film. The script for this doesn't exist.
This is a Theon film.
Yeah, the script is rubbish. It's ridiculous. The gender politics are very, very, very backward as well.
Yeah.
To say the least. Bryce Dallas Howard, who, to be honest, I don't think is a particularly good actress anyway. Her character is just ridiculous. She's supposed to be this strong, important female in a position of power, but she very quickly becomes... I think I described this film as if they remade Romancing the Stone with Jeremy Clarkson, right? It's got the whole... it's basically just this really retrograde, quite sexist idea that this strong woman who, Kathleen Turner could have played this part 25 years ago, right? It's that kind of just... She starts off and she's supposed to be powerful and in charge, but she's a bit brittle and a bit icy. She can't connect with her family and her nephews. The moment she sees Chris Pratt and his big arms, she's all, let's in the middle of my nephews almost being eaten by a fucking dinosaur. Let's have a flirt. Let's have a kiss. Let's talk about things. This is the other thing, and I talked to my housemates about this earlier. At no point do any of these people react in the way that you would if a rampaging psychopathic dinosaur hybrid was about to eat 2,000 people. You wouldn't just suddenly start having a flirt. You wouldn't just suddenly sort of forget that there's a couple of kids on the loose. It's just so stupid, this film. It beggars belief. It's fun, but it is the most dumb film I think I've watched in some time.
I think one of the big... things that highlights that to me, obviously, besides the Bryce Dallas Howard thing, was when they're in the gyrospheres and that they are able to go off road into the jungle. Like, there's no way that attraction would be controlled by the people in the sphere.
No,
it's more unbelievable than them bringing dinosaurs back to life.
Is Jimmy Fallon in a Jurassic Park?
Yeah,
that's the point. The irony of this is, and this is the big irony of this film. This film has spent 15 years, countless drafts, loads of scripts, Spielberg never been quite happy with what it was, and then Colin Trevorrow comes in, who did Safety Not Guaranteed, and it was, that was a nice little indie kind of slightly quirky film. Not bad, not brilliant, but not bad. A director with potential comes in, decides to rewrite it, happens upon the fact that the very clever idea, in fact, and it's bizarre that nobody got to this quicker.
It's a brilliant idea.
To actually make the park, which is what originally the first film was leading up to actually go to that point, it makes a world of sense. It's the obvious story for Jurassic Park to go.
It's a brilliant conceit, isn't it?
It's a great conceit.
That sells the film immediately.
This whole idea
is open as
well.
It's a tagline.
The park is open. This whole idea that we're, and quite right idea, that we've reached this point of consumer excess, that all we want is more, bigger, more. You see it in, you see it in theme parks. I mean, look at the whole Smiler thing in Milton Towers, right? You see it with all this right now. You see it with movies where it's bigger, more, franchises, massiveness, tons of films, you know, galactic-wide madness. You see it all the time. It makes complete sense that you would some idiot would open a fucking park like this, right? The only problem is, this film, it's like it's eaten itself, because it's exactly the kind of corporate cash-in that this film is trying to satirise. I mean, did you notice the product placement?
Yeah,
I don't think it can help, but
I was reading about that.
Is it intentional?
Where it wasn't the studio. It wasn't the studio's idea for all the product placement. It was Trevorrow to put it in, because that's what the park would be like if it was a real park.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think the excess of money pouring in as well wouldn't have harmed matters. But
well, yeah, exactly. I understand that, but I think that the whole point of this film is that it's trying to satirise something that it's become itself. And now the fact it's made 500 million in its first opening weekend actually is
ridiculous.
To break all records.
Yeah.
I'm not even remotely surprised. You know, I'm actually quite glad, because I like the franchise, right? I've got nothing against this film. I think it's fun. I think it's harmless. I think the action's good. I think it's fairly
enjoyable.
Put together. It's enjoyable. There was a moment There was a moment that reminded me of for a fleeting moment, of the awe of the first film, where the kids run into the hotel room, you've got the theme playing, and they open the shutters and you see the park in all its glory. That was one moment where I thought, okay, that reminds me a little bit of that kind of wow moment from the first film. Not as good, but it reminded me of that. But then it just, it's so stupid. I mean, the whole thing you know, the very idea of Chris Pratt being able to get raptors to run with him on a bike and then not kill him is just lunacy.
I still prefer that to the strange idea Vincent D'Onofrio has of them becoming weapons. Like, he's an idiot, but even it has to be a limit. Who would realistically deploy dinosaurs as weapons of war?
If you thought there were plot holes in the last two films, they've got nothing on this. I mean, you could drive a T-Rex through the plot holes in this film.
What it makes up for is it does it with such gusto and with such bravura that you sort of think, yeah, technically this falls apart on pretty much any level, but you're with it just because it's a hell of a ride.
You are. I would agree. It is a ride. But I don't think...
It's not anyone who proves it's better than the first one. I have to have a long chat with you afterwards.
Remonstrate with them. It's rubbish. The very idea of that is rubbish. Of course it isn't. But it's better than
the second best film. The second best Jurassic World film.
But if it, and this there will be a sequel. I mean, without shadow.
Jurassic
Act,
Worlds. Already, right? Jurassic World. Dinosaurs on the moon. That's it right there. Dinosaurs on the moon.
I would venture that the any next film will go back to the mainland now and try and do something.
Oh no!
Somehow.
As long as it isn't like the end of Lost World. But don't go to San Diego.
No. Yeah, because Pete hates San Diego. Let's not go there. I think it's a load of old tosh, but it was an enjoyable load of old tosh.
I'd rather this smash records than Transformers.
Yes, it's me too. By far. That's it then. We're at the end of the dinosaur. Come on, that was good. Come on.
Better than the last two.
It is better. It's getting better, you see. So yeah, we're at the end of the of our Jurassic special. Thank you for listening. This just leaves me to thank my guests and ask them if they would like to shill their Twitters or anything they've got on. So, Luke, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Facebook, but I don't really use it. I will use this time, though, to plug a charity that I've been involved with recently called Mummy's Star, which is the only charity that focuses on cancer during and post-pregnancy. Which you never hear about, and you know cancer's bad enough as it is, but I just think you get told that you're going to be a parent, and then 6 months later, you told, oh, actually, you've got cancer as well. I just think it's a horrible, horrible thing. And for there to be only... I'd never even thought about it until I got involved with this charity. Yeah. I just think it's... They do really good work. They're called Mummy's Star. And, everyone should go donate lots and lots of money to them.
Are they on Twitter?
They are. It's at Mummy's Star, MUMMYSSTAR.
Mm. Oh, thank you for plugging
that. I'll tweet a link to you guys.
Yeah, please do. Very, very worthy cause, yeah. That's lovely. I hope people donate some stuff to those guys. Yeah, Pete.
Yes, I feel incredibly selfish now.
Well, why break the habit of a lifetime?
Exactly. You can find me on Twitter if you want it, PD Gaskell. You can try and find me on Facebook, but I probably won't add you unless I like you.
Win over people, Pete. There you go.
Oh yes, there you go. Also, I host a podcast. Well, I call it a podcast. It's more of a vidcast, really, on YouTube called The Word of Nerd Show. Basically, it's me and a few other people, including Black Hole Cinema's Dan Taylor as a regular. We get together every Friday night and talk geeky, nerdy news and stuff and play games and generally go mad. If you like a bit of a, nerdy nerd out with lots of laughs, then, it might be worth a pop over to YouTube, and we are just look for The Word of Nerd Show on YouTube and on Twitter.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
And also donate to Luke's charity.
Yes, I would second that. Pete now has redeemed himself for being such a selfish bastard by saying that, so well done. As ever, you can find me at Black Hole Writer on Twitter and Black Hole Cinema on Twitter and, of course, in Facebook, where we post our new episodes. Look us up. So thanks, guys. Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And we'll be back next week for a standard episode where Dan Taylor will be back hosting for the first time in a while. And we'll be reviewing the latest movies. So from us, we're going to stomp our way to... And I'm not even going to try and do dinosaur puns because I've forgotten. So I'm just going to say bye for the better. Thanks, guys.